Good morning, everybody. This is Jim Bianco. Welcome to the conference call. As usual, we have our little housekeeping item up front. There's a handout. Hopefully, there's not a problem. There usually isn't. If for whatever reason you couldn't get the handout, send Ryan Malo an email in our office at rmalo@biancoresearch.com, and he'll turn right around and he'll shoot you out the handout as an attachment on email. At the end of the call, there will be questions. You'll be able to ask questions either live. Remember that we use first name only. I know who you are because we feel that encourages questions. Or you can email me a question, and I'll try and read them and get to as many of them as I can at the end of the call. Current state of the credit crisis is the topic. Let's go to page 2. This is a summary that I've been using for about the last month or so. I still think it applies. Everyone loves analogies. Asteroid hit the hit in early July, and all the dinosaurs are dying, Freddie, Fannie, Lehman, Merrill, AIG. And this is what I wrote on September 18th. Now, Morgan Stanley, which one they were at the time, they were teetering, and WaMu. I might add Wachovia to that list now. After the hit, the only food left are those financial institutions that are light on mortgage holdings and get their funding from a retail deposit base. Either get with a food source or die, and that's exactly what Merrill did by hooking up with Bank of America. But here's why I really put this in here to reiterate it. We believe this is the final capitulation process. It's the beginning of the end. Within the next 3 months, and remember I wrote this mid-September, so by the end of the year, the low price and the high spread should be in place. However, between now and then, it will not be pleasant. Both the high-yield investment-grade option spreads have widened by a similar amount, over 100 basis points in the last week, and that continues to this day. The objective is to stay in business, as those listed above have not survived, and the last few weeks have attested to it. It's not as easy as it sounds. So let me reiterate that I do think that this is the beginning of the end for the financial markets. Let me be clear on that distinction, that we will get the wide credit spread, we will get the low stock price between, say, now and Christmas. Was it this morning? It's impossible to call it within a day. I've also said repeatedly, and I'll repeat this again, I would rather be a month late in saying that the bottom is in than a month early. Last Friday, we signed the bailout bill. The bailout bill that everybody said was going to preserve our way of life. That was the way it was sold. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is 1,300 points lower since the moment we signed the bailout bill. Credit spreads, high yield spreads are 75 basis points wider. Investment grade spreads are 50 basis points wider. So I would rather be a month late than a month early when it comes to the beginning of the end. And again, this is for the financial markets. The tight credit markets, the lingering recession, the feeling that this is not getting better will last well into 2009. But as is usually the case, you would look for the financial markets to bottom first. And by having the financial markets bottom first, I think we would have that will happen sooner rather than later. Page 3. At the risk of sounding a tad arrogant, I'm getting a bit frustrated with a lot of the commentators that are talking about the credit crisis. A lot of them are not in the credit markets, and even some of them that are, and they keep simplifying this problem to that it is just a confidence problem, and that there is in that their attitude, and if you want me to pick on one guy, I'll pick on Steve Forbes this morning on Squawk Box. Their attitude is there's really nothing wrong with anything in the world. It's just a bunch of bankers acting irrationally. And once they get rational again, or once we slap them on the side of the head enough and they start acting normally, this problem goes away. Or there's that magic bullet cure-all, and now the new magic bullet cure-all is mark-to-market accounting. And I don't think that will be just the next in a long line of ideas that everybody thinks will fix the problem but won't. But before I get into mark-to-market accounting, let me talk about page 3. It is confidence problem, but bigger than the confidence problem, there is, if you will, a physical problem. These tables we've used almost every week for the last probably year or so. It details the losses in the capital raised worldwide as of a couple of days ago. Bank of America's capital raise is not yet on this list. Financial institutions, banks, and brokers are listed in the table in the upper right with the detail on the left. And non-broker losses are listed on the bottom. We see AIG, Fannie, Freddie, and a lot of the monoline insurance companies. To date, if you add this up, we're talking about nearly $700 billion, maybe $650 to $700 billion of losses against $432 billion of capital raised. The problem is very simply stated. Home prices got into a bubble. We made an error in thinking that home prices were always going to go up because we had history that the last 50 years we could show you price charts of home prices, and they always did go up. If you want to know what that attitude is about, call a real estate broker, and they will tell you about how home prices never ever go down except last year, and now they never ever will go down again for the next 100 years. We levered ourselves to home prices to a degree we've never seen before. When home prices started to fall, the banking system took horrific losses. That's what's detailed out here on page 3. Non-bank brokers and insurance companies took horrific losses as well, too. Their capital base shrunk. They were not able to raise enough capital to offset those losses. The financial system is now significantly smaller than it was a year or 18 months ago. The economy and the financial markets demand a certain level of lending every day. It is impossible to meet those lending needs because of the shrinkage in the financial system. So it's not just a credit, it's not just a confidence problem. It's not just that there's nothing wrong and Steve Forbes wants to think that if bankers would just start lending, everything goes away. It's a bigger problem. If they start lending to the ability that they have with the capital that they have, there's not enough money to go around, if I want to be simple about it. And that's the problem. Choices have to be made. The more levered institutions, those that rely the most on funding, which happen to be financial institutions, are the ones that are losing the worst on the market. That's why we seem to be having this crisis. Ultimately, I've argued the fix, if there is a fix, is going to be a massive recapitalization of the banking system. That recapitalization of the banking system has to not only cover the $650 billion of losses that we've seen so far, but it has to cover what would have been the growth in financial capital over the last 18 months. The estimates are $300 to $400 billion needs to be raised in order to recapitalize the banking system. The problem is look at Bank of America yesterday. They raised $10 billion. They were supposed to have it priced before the open yesterday. It took them until after the close. It was a struggle beyond belief for the largest, best run, considered the safest bank in the world to raise $10 billion. How are we going to get the other 290 if it's that hard for Bank of America to raise the money? Ultimately, that is the problem. The issues that we've had with the marketplace, and if you go to page 4, is that the central banks, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, down to the TARP, have been attacking this problem as a liquidity problem. It is not a liquidity problem. It's a solvency or a capital problem. What's the difference? Capital tells you how much your potential lending ability is. As I've argued before, using simple numbers for a conference call presentation, whatever the capital base is of the financial markets, or of financial institutions, and it's really hard to determine what those numbers are worldwide, because they're it's not that simple. Nobody aggregates those numbers and says capital worldwide is X. It's estimated to be about something like $1.5 trillion or so, down from 2 from where we were about 18 months ago. But that's only estimates. Capital tells you that number, $1.5 trillion times, say, 14, is how much the capacity is of the system to hand out loans, call it $15 trillion or $20 trillion or so. Liquidity is how close can you get to your capacity number? How efficient can I be with my capital? Can I go all the way up to that $20 trillion number? Or do I have illiquid assets that are going to hold me back from that? But what if the world needs $25 trillion in loans and capital only allows us to give 20? These are not the exact numbers. I'm using them for illustrative purposes. You can throw all the liquidity in the world at the markets, and it will only help to a point. And it did help to a point. And if you look at these charts on page 4 with LIBOR, it helped with a point, and that point was, if you look at the chart on the upper right, and this is updated through yesterday, today's three-month LIBOR was 453, so I'd have to rescale the chart to put today in there. That bend up in the LIBOR at 280 was September 15th. September 15th was the day after Lehman Brothers failed. I think that when Hank Paulson came out and said that Lehman Brothers was, we had 6 months to prepare for it, we had to draw the line with all of these bailouts, he had no idea the tsunami he was about to unleash on the markets. And what they've been responding with is they've been responding with liquidity injections when we actually need capital. So when you look at these charts, what you see is the liquidity injections are not working. In addition to the chart of LIBOR on the upper right, the chart on the left shows the TED spread, the difference between three-month bills and three-month LIBOR. It recently hit 383 basis points yesterday. Today it's almost 400 basis points. It's well in excess of where we were during the stock market crash of 1987. So, excuse me, it is, the liquidity is not solving the problem. If you look at the chart in the lower right, the way LIBOR is calculated is there's 16 banks, and each one of them reports to the British Bankers Association their interest rate that they're willing to lend at for three-month deposits. There's the list of the 16 banks. They do what's called a trim mean. Think of the figure skating approach to everything. You throw out the four highest, you throw out the four lowest, and you average the eight in the middle. And normally the difference between the highest and the lowest until August of last year was maybe one basis point, usually less. Until a couple of weeks ago, it was, you know, at extremes 20 basis points between the highest and the lowest. It's been averaging 100, and last night it was 180 basis points between the highest bank and the lowest bank. So LIBOR is all over the place because certain banks just don't want to lend, so they put up a very high number. They don't want to lend because they don't have the capacity to lend anymore because they don't have the capital to lend anymore. That, in essence, is the problem. We need capital into the system. If we go to page 5. Part of the other problems with the marketplace is commercial paper. Commercial paper's problem is a legacy problem of Lehman Brothers. When Lehman Brothers failed, let me go to page 6 first, and let me explain it this way because I think it would be better. When Lehman Brothers failed, they had some short-term debt that was due the 15th or 16th to a mutual fund called the Reserve Fund. And there's some stories back from mid-September about it on the left on page 6. The Reserve Fund had $62 billion in assets. When Lehman couldn't pay, the Reserve Fund broke the buck, trading at $96. Remember, under SEC Rule 2A7, all money market funds will report an NAV of $1. They'll vary their interest rate every day as opposed to their NAV. And that is what we've expected. No money market fund has broken that $1 NAV since 1994. Then when the Reserve Fund broke the buck, it set off a chain reaction. If you look at the chart on page 6, you'll see that the outflows came from institutional money funds, the red line, not from retail money funds, the blue line. After Lehman Brothers failed, there was a call to all institutional money managers. You run money for me. Do you have any exposure to Lehman and AIG? No, we do not, said the money manager. What are you doing with your cash? Well, we don't have cash managers anymore because there's been a move among them to push it off to an institutional money fund. What does your money fund invest in? Well, you call up their website, you look at their June 30th statement, and there is some short-term repo with Lehman. There might be some AIG paper. So you do have exposure to Lehman and AIG, and the manager's answer was, not in about 20 minutes because I'm going to pull all that money out. So you might have a $50 billion institutional money fund, and he might have $50 million of repo with Lehman. And when everybody realizes there's a Lehman exposure, $45 billion wanted to come out of that fund. That was the crisis that we hit with money funds that the Fed was trying to alleviate. And everybody yanked their money out. Back on the 19th, they alleviated that by giving the dealers non-recourse loans to buy back this paper. So then you call up those institutional managers, if you're the money fund, and say, you know, you wanted to pull your $100 million out of my fund because we had Lehman exposure. We no longer have it. I sold it to a dealer. There's no Lehman exposure. Oh, okay, well, maybe I don't have to sell now because you don't have any exposure. But what's happened is now everybody wants these funds, these money funds, to be liquid, to be secure, to be in known safe assets. So if you go to page 5, one of the losers in that has been the asset-backed commercial paper market. They've been selling, refusing to roll over their asset-backed commercial paper, and that's why you've seen the plunge in the left standing, especially among financial firms, which is the lower left, and you've seen these rates soar, so much so that the Fed had to put together a facility yesterday so that the asset-backed commercial paper market could continue to function because of the loss of a critical buyer in this market. This is also having the effect of having all of these funds draw down on their backup lines of credit, further squeezing the amount of lending that is available in the marketplace. So it is a capacity problem highlighted with a confidence problem. The ultimate fix to the capacity problem is going to be if we were to recapitalize the firms. Let's jump to page 7. Page 7. Mortgage and agency spreads. I wanted to go through, a lot of people have asked, when is the worst going to be over, or when are we going to turn the corner on this credit crisis? And one of the things I've been emphasizing now for many months is it gets worse almost every day. So we have to, first of all, look for signs of a bottom instead of asking, when are we going to catch the falling knife? Because the next series of charts is going to show that that's pretty much what we have. First of all, the upper left chart, Freddie and Fannie mortgage spreads over treasuries. You can see I've got listed there September 5th. That was the day we nationalized Fannie and Freddie. Down to September 15th, we had a dramatic 50 basis points narrowing in mortgage spreads. We've given almost all of it back. The chart below it is the same measure going back 23 years, so you can see that at around 200 basis points, we are at about the widest levels that we've ever seen, save where we were in March. Again, I think it's important to understand that the reason Fannie and Freddie were nationalized was, it's not like I heard Steve Forbes, I'm going to pick on him today, he's going to be my whipping boy, but I've heard others say this too, that it was FASB 157 that sunk them because of fair market accounting. They're not required to use FASB 157. OFAIL has them use a different set of rules altogether, so he's factually wrong on that. But more importantly, I think what caused them to come in was a loss of confidence among foreign investors. In the last conference call and in our TIC update, we showed a chart where foreign investors had liquidated $50 billion of agency debt, and they still, I think, to this day, have not returned to the agency market, which necessitated the nationalization of Fannie and Freddie. They lost their funding source, which in a large part was foreign investors. If you look at the chart on the right on page 7, agency spreads continue to widen out. They're almost back to their March panic levels, and these agencies have been nationalized, and these spreads continue to widen out, highlighting that idea that they've lost their funding source of foreign investors. If we go to page 8, it was fun a couple of days ago. Excuse me. It was fun a couple of days ago when California asked the Treasury, Hank Paulson, for a bailout. And then Monday, Massachusetts asked one for the same thing. But it's wreaking havoc on the muni market. The muni market is now in bigger chaos than it was back last March. If you look at these charts, I show general obligation indexes. These are Bloomberg indexes as a percentage of Treasury's yield. Remember that, and the bottom chart just shows the 10-year going back 18 years. The top chart shows the 10-year in blue and the 5-year in red. Remember that normally munis should trade at a discount because of their tax-free status. They're trading at huge premiums. California and Massachusetts asking for a bailout has thrown this market into chaos. When we threw this market into chaos in March, it resulted in the auction rate securities market blowing up, and now we've got it in a worse position now than we've had before. All these states asking for bailouts is making the situation worse, because if they're going to assume they can't roll over their debt, if they're going to assume they need a bailout, then I don't want to own their GOs, and now the GO market is in complete chaos as well, too. And finally, on page 9, credit spreads. The top chart shows, top left chart on page 9, shows investment-grade credit spreads. It shows that as of the 6th, they hit an incredible level of 508 basis points in the Merrill Lynch Investment Grade Index, almost double what it was during the October 2002 peak. High yield spreads, which is the red line below, has hit 1,300 basis points, well above that peak, but not quite double that peak. Those levels are significantly worse today as well, too. And what we're seeing here, again, I want to highlight this. Investment grade is doing far worse on a relative basis than high yield. Again, why is that? Because what we've learned, because of the CDS market and hedge funds, a lot of investment grade debt gets bought on leverage. And we're deleveraging a lot of the hedge funds. They don't have, we're finding out how much, maybe even the muni market, the mortgage market, as we showed before, even some to extent the agency investment grade market. There was a buyer called a levered hedge fund that would use borrowed money to buy. They can't do it. The market has to adjust to the reality that a certain buyer is gone. That's why the highest quality instruments are getting hit worse, and it's best shown on this page. Investment grade doing far worse than high yield. And if you go to page 10, and this is updated through yesterday because we did it right on the close, the bottom chart shows that the sell-off in the S&P is not as bad as the 2000 to 2002 sell-off. Maybe I should say yet. We've sold off 36% from our high almost a year ago today. During the 2000 to 2002 peak, the sell-off was 49%. Why is that? Because the least amount of levered buying occurs in equities. Equities don't have the levered buyer that investment grade or munis or mortgages or agencies will have. Because if you're going to borrow at 10-to-1 leverage, you want to buy something that's AAA and has a very good chance of paying you back and play carry. When you get to high yield and when you get to equities, you just want them to go up. And you don't really need a lot of leverage. And so that's why as you move down the credit spectrum, you see the markets getting worse. This is all part and parcel of the deleveraging that has been going on in the marketplace. Page 11. A byproduct of that has been soaring volatility. You can see that the VIX index has hit nearly 60 on its volatility in the last couple of days. That is, only two other periods have been higher than that, one day in 1998 and the stock market crash of 87. So other than that, that's all we've had. The Merrill option volatility estimate, which goes back to 1998, which, if you will, is a VIX for the bond market, is at an all-time high. It was at an all-time low 18 months ago. So it's gone the complete gamut from its all-time high to its all-time low in the last 18 months. And euro volatility is spiking with the problems that Europe is having. The problems Europe is having that during this crisis, if you go back to page 3, I won't have you go back there, but what I've pointed out much in the past is if you look at the losses in the banking system, other than the third quarter, the U.S. usually announces first and Europe comes back. Second quarter on back, European banks have had as many losses as American banks. This credit crisis is every bit the European problem. The banking system took losses. It doesn't have the capacity, whether it's Europe or the United States, to hand out loans. The difference is, in Europe now, the weakness of the EU structure is showing up. We've got a common currency among 15 different countries and 27 different players, and they're arguing to each other in 8 different languages, and they cannot come to a conclusion. Every man for himself, they all seem to be doing different things, and that's why you're hearing the idea that the euro is in trouble. Not that Europe is in trouble, it's that this was what everybody was afraid of when they invented the euro. That in extreme periods, the Germans would do one thing, the Irish would do a second thing, the Greeks would do a third thing, the Italians would scream that nothing is working, and that's exactly what's happened over the last week or so, and that makes the situation far worse than what you have in the United States. At least you have a coordinated attempt between two people, Treasury and the Fed, to try and deal with this problem. If we go to page 12, again, I want to talk a little bit about moves that have been made to date. And I want to emphasize, no one move is going to fix this problem. There isn't a magic bullet that if we do this, the problem goes away. As my whipping boy Steve Forbes likes to say, just get rid of mark-to-market accounting and the problem goes away. It doesn't go away. The problem with mark-to-market accounting is that we're talking about level three assets, and I wrote about this in our news clips again today. Level three assets, management opinion. It is not management opinion. It is the accountant or the auditor's opinion. They remember Enron. Enron used fraudulent accounting to value their assets. They blew up. We seeked out Arthur Andersen, their accountant, and we liquidated the firm. We imposed a death penalty on them because of that sin. Every auditor that audits a financial firm is scared to death. They are scared to death. These guys are going to cook the books. They're going to seek out Deloitte Touche or PricewaterhouseCoopers or Grant Thornton, whoever it happens to be, and say, you're all out of business now, just like Andersen. So it's the auditor, the accountant, that is forcing liquidation values to protect his franchise. This is the unintended consequence of blowing up Arthur Andersen. It is supposed to be management's opinion. And the SEC and the AICPA, who put together FASB 157 and put out rule after rule saying you do not have to use liquidation value, but you can't get it past the auditor. So the problem is, at this late stage, if we rescind mark-to-market accounting, we further obfuscate the problem. If the problem has been somewhat that no one trusts financial statements, let's make them less trustworthy is going to make the problem worse. Second of all, if you rescind mark-to-market accounting, there's no guarantee that the auditing firms or the accountants are going to say, oh, okay, now we can now use make-believe numbers on these valuations. We can now value all these assets 50% higher because we've changed the accounting rule, because now if you blow up under this plan, I won't get liquidated. No, they're still afraid they're going to get liquidated. I don't know how you exonerate the accounting firms from any kind of liability if they were to put a value on these numbers at some point down the line. So that's going to be the problem that we have to face. That's why mark-to-market accounting can't be the fix. On page 12, the Federal Reserve has gone through extraordinary actions. They have blown their balance sheet up, as is shown in the upper left corner. I've gotten a lot of questions about this. Excuse my cough. I thought I was over this. I've gotten a lot of questions about this, so let me go through this quickly, kind of a high school type of answer. And that is that total Federal Reserve credit, every bank is supposed to hold reserves with the Federal Reserve. And then from those reserves, there's a multiplier effect as to how much money you can lend. On the regulated side, the multiplier effect is roughly 10 to 1, just to use a simple answer. So for every dollar in reserves you hold, you can hand out $10 in loans. Up until 2 days ago, reserves never paid interest. When the Fed has the ability to add money to everybody's reserve account or drain money from everybody's reserve account. It was then up to the individual banks, if they had too many reserves, to sell those to banks that were short reserves, or vice versa, and put each other in the balance. That's the Fed funds market. The Fed funds market has two measures. There's the target rate, which was cut today to 150, and then there's the actual rate at which where it trades, or known as the effective rate. The effective rate, the Fed would always manipulate its balance sheet in that nice smooth line to try and get the effective rate to trade on the target rate set by the FOMC. Well, when this crisis post Lehman Brothers hit, the Fed has been pumping unprecedented sums of liquidity into the financial system. That unprecedented sums of liquidity are shown in these other charts. The bottom left chart shows securities lent by the Fed is now almost $260 billion. The bottom right chart shows that the Fed used to have almost $800 billion of treasury. Now they have about $500 billion, of which they've pledged about $260 in lending, so they only have about $250 billion of unencumbered treasuries, down from $800 billion. If you turn the page, and these are hard to explain to people, the discount window borrowings, which are detailed in the table there, are nearly $400 billion. Up until a few weeks ago, the all-time record was $11 billion the day after 9/11. If it used to get to 1 or 2, we would scream that the financial system was in trouble. 1 or 2 billion meant the financial system was in trouble maybe a year ago. Now we're at 400 to try and give you an idea of how much money that the Fed has thrown. These are detailed again on page 13. But if you go back to page 12, all of this has had the effect of the chart on the upper right. If the Fed is going to pump liquidity into the financial system and pump it in a big way into the financial system, then everybody's going to be over-reserved. And that means then that everybody's a seller of Fed funds. The effective rate is going to plummet well under 2%, which is what it's done. The Fed has tried to alleviate this problem in the last 2 days by, in the bailout bill, getting permission to pay interest on reserves. So that $1.3 trillion in assets, you see, paid no interest. Now it does. For required reserves, they pay 10 basis points less than the target rate, which means that whatever you're required to have, you're going to get paid 1.4%. For reserves that are in excess, you're going to get paid 75 basis points less than the target rate, which means you're going to get 75 basis points in reserves. The effect of that was supposed to be to bring the effective rate back in line with the target rate, because otherwise I've been arguing in some pieces over the last few weeks that the target rate has no meaning, because effectively we've been trading well under that level. Well, the Fed has done its part, and this is more of the same. This is more of the liquidity squeeze that we have seen in the marketplace right now, and that liquidity squeeze is only helping to a point. We need capital. We need much more capital in the financial system. Let me jump us then to page 15 and point out that the deleveraging, I think, is only just started in the financial system, and this is the scary part. I think that the deleveraging that everybody's been talking about was really only happening in a marginal way until the Lehman Brothers failure came down, and now it's been happening in a big way. This chart shows, for one measure of deleveraging, primary dealer bond market leverage. The 18 or so dealers that are left are borrowing among themselves about $1.3 trillion or so, $1.35 trillion is what that chart shows, down from about $1.5 trillion. So they're down $200 billion or so in borrowing, and this data is 3 weeks old. Tomorrow we'll get the data. Tomorrow we're going to get the data for the next couple of weeks or so, and we expect to see a number lower. But as I show in the table on this chart, that doesn't mean that we've delevered about 20% of the dealer community. They're borrowing this from the Fed. So they've just changed their financing source. But now I think we're finally going to start seeing some real, deleveraging in the market. The problem is deleveraging is excruciatingly painful. This is when firms go out of business, markets go down, it gets ugly, it gets nasty. What we would prefer is to recapitalize the financial system. I think the UK had it right last night by investing in financial firms. Ultimately, I've argued that the ultimate fix might be that everybody, sovereign wealth funds, private equity funds, institutional investors, are all going to have to hold hands, and they're all going to have to say, look, if we want to do what's in our best interest and stay away from all the financial firms, we're all sunk. But the only way we could salvage the system is if we all hold hands and we all plow $400 billion into all these financial firms and recapitalize them. Sovereign wealth funds, instead of walking around, you know, patting yourself on the back going, God, I'm glad I didn't invest in any of these firms, it almost might get to the point where it doesn't matter, that we're going to have to get capital into these firms in a big way. And by getting capital into these firms in a big way, I think would help alleviate the system more than all of the liquidity. Because liquidity is simply helps to the point of capital, and that's where we're at right now with the marketplace. All right, let me stop there. Let me mention that, as is the case with these markets, that breaking news has occurred during this call. The breaking news is that the Treasury is reopening a bunch of securities because they see dislocations in the Treasury market. We're going to have a $10 billion six-year and seven-month auction. We're going to have Treasury auctions. I'm just reading this across the tape right now. Across the board to try and relieve some of the illiquidity in the Treasury market. I think it's important to note that I've argued, and some people have asked me this question, given those charts that I show of the Fed, given all of the extraordinary moves, shouldn't all of this stuff be hyperinflationary? And the answer is yes, it would be in normal period. But in this period where the financial system or the banking system is not functioning properly, it's deflationary. And be careful, if I'm wrong and there is a magic bullet, a rescind mark to market, and Steve Forbes happens to be right and that's it, the last crisis will be a complete collapse of the Treasury market, because then we will have everybody get out of Treasuries, we will have them get in the risk assets at the same time. They're going to look at the Fed's balance sheet, they're going to look at everything that all of the finance ministers in the U.S. Treasury Department have done, and they're going to conclude that it's going to lead to a giant burst of inflation. That's the last crisis, is when we explode the Treasury market, because we're trying to inflate the hell out of this problem, and it's not working. But boy, if it ever gained traction, then you would really see the Treasury market take it in a bad way. The dislocations we see in the Treasury market now is that I think everybody's still using the Treasury market as a vehicle, at least to hide in. And if we ever got to the point where they thought that all of this stuff was just going to be hyperinflationary, then the Treasury market is going to have some real problems. All right. Hopefully that puts an answer of questions to what I think has been happening. The ultimate answer, again, is raise capital. The UK had a better idea what they did last night, more so than what we saw with the TARP plan last week. And I could take questions on that or anything else. To ask a question, it's £7. To ask a question live, you can email me by hitting reply on the emails we've sent you for this conference call, or send it to jbianco@biancoresearch.com. Again, we do first name only. We do that because we feel that that invites questions for people to ask. And so we'll take questions in one of two ways, either via email or live. So let me start with some of the live questions. Mark, you're live with us. Did you have a question?
Hey, Jim. Yeah, looking two steps down the road here, we've just exploded the Fed's balance sheet by, $500 billion or something like that, basically to keep the wheels going. The question I have is, when they ultimately unwind that explosion in the balance sheet, doesn't that sort of continue the deflationary problem, or will we already be past that and into the back into the risk-based asset?
Well, yeah, I mean, that therein lies the problem, is that it will either continue the deflationary problem, and you're right. Howard works with me, likes to often say that the hallmark of this crisis is numbers so large nobody understands what they mean. I'm still struggling to understand what a $400 billion discount window borrowing means or exploding the balance sheet by $500 billion. But you're right. When we get to the point where we say, hey, you know what, we're getting past this problem and banks are starting to lend, the system is starting to move forward again, credit spreads are starting to narrow, then what? We got to get rid of $500 billion of borrowing off of the Fed's balance sheet. If we do that, that's highly deflationary. If we don't do that, if we're like Japan, after quantitative easing, they can only raise rates to 50 basis points, and then they were deathly afraid to go any further, we're going to have a gigantic spurt of inflation. If inflation is too much money chasing too few goods, well, we've created more money in the last 3 weeks than we did in the prior 14 years combined. And that is going to be unbelievably deflationary. So that's why Treasury securities are the preferred place to hide right now until the crisis, somebody blows the whistle and says the crisis is over, and then they're going to be every bit as ugly as we think the stock market is or anything else is right now, because then they've got the two-time loser everybody wants into risk assets, and we've got the most inflationary policy we've seen basically since we've invented the Federal Reserve in 1913. Mark, did you have a follow-up to that?
Thanks so much.
Sure. Live question is from Richard. Richard, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Jim. My question is, what do you think we can expect in the higher ed segment of the commercial paper market from an issuer standpoint, considering your page 5 and the Fed's announcement yesterday of purchasing up all the short-term debt?
What do you mean by higher ed? I'm not following.
I mean versus the financial market commercial paper issuance, just higher education issuers.
You know, I don't know enough about the commercial paper market to say, to be specific either way, but I would say a couple of things. First of all, non-financial commercial paper, if you look at the chart on page 5, it's about $200 billion. That should be okay. The problems come in asset-backed, and the problems come in financial. As far as the higher ed CP goes, that's going to be more associated, I think, with municipals than anything else.
Yeah, it will.
The decisions by California and Massachusetts to ask for a bailout and the assumption that 48 other states will be asking for one shortly is going to wreak havoc in the muni market, and you saw that with the GO charts that I showed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be very difficult for any kind of a municipality or quasi-municipality issue to try and separate themselves from everything else, because the buyer of this is now not discriminating. The buyer is saying either I want munis in all shapes and sizes or I don't want munis in all shapes or sizes, and they're all getting thrown out with the bathwater. So the Fed's facility, and they really haven't given us any details on how it's going to work, just that they're going to do it, I think is all it's meant to be is a stopgap measure. It's to try and get us through to tomorrow. It's try and get us through to next week. But ultimately, they cannot be required or responsible to finance the short-term funding obligations of not only higher ed, but everybody else that's on this list. It's going to have to come back to the private market. We have to get through this crisis first before we go anywhere else.
Okay, thank
you. Do you have a follow-up to that?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. All right, let me take a couple of questions that I have had emailed into me. First one is from Bruce. Do you think a $400 billion capital would require congressional action? Do you see this ultimately happening soon, or is it months away? One of the questions that has come up about the TARP plan is the TARP plan is $700 billion. And what I found that's very interesting about the TARP plan is you can divide everybody into two categories, those that think it's going to work and those that don't think it's going to work. Those that think the TARP plan are going to not work, I think, fall into the category that I was in. And I used to say I didn't think it was going to do anything. I didn't think it was going to be bad or it was going to be good. It was going to be a non-event because they read the law as it was written and they shrug their shoulders and go, well, how is putting a floor on mortgage securities going to recapitalize the banking system? I don't get it, unless they overpay. If you listen to those that believe it's going to work, and let me use Warren Buffett as my example. Buffett believes it's going to work and it's necessary, and when you ask him why, he says, yeah, we need a floor on these plans, but then he also says, I trust the Treasury and Hank Paulson to do the right thing. And I interpret that to mean, you know, that 451 pages we had of rules, well, forget that. Just give Hank the money, and Hank will do whatever he needs to do. Now, there's a growing chorus of people that think that the TARP plan is written with sufficiently loose enough language that it can serve as a de facto capitalization plan for the banking system. And if it is, well, other than the point that I don't understand the law enough to say I read the bill and I didn't see it in there, there are some language that could be interpreted that way. But this was supposed to be an asset purchase plan, not necessarily a recapitalization plan. If it is, it would help in that regard. Another way that they can have it happen with the TARP plan is if they pay, you know, the long-term value levels of those securities, as Bernanke said, and that was code word for overpay, which is a de facto recapitalization. Well, if you're going to do that, just recapitalize the bank. So would a separate bill be required for congressional action? My guess is yes, and I'm not an expert on Congress. But also, those that think the TARP is a good idea and will work have argued that they could do it under the TARP. It's just forget what you think the TARP is going to do. Buy MBS, non-agency MBS to establish a floor, hold those MBS, trade in and out of those MBS to try and get a market going to restore confidence in the market and eventually get the private market to capitalize it. No, that's not what they're going to do. They're just going to use this bill to recapitalize. There's the possibility that it could happen that way, so that the TARP could do it, but not as the way we understood it, which was the basis for me saying I didn't believe it. Otherwise, yes, I do think that there would have to be some other kind of another type of an option. And I got a question from Laura that says, I also heard there's a provision in the TARP that would give the Treasury the option to do what the UK has decided to do, invest directly in the banks. Yes, I've heard this too. I've read that section of the bill. Quite frankly, I'm not an expert in congressional law. I didn't understand it. I've been told by some that yes, it can mean that. I've been told by others that no, it can't mean that as well. Matt writes in, it appears that the Fed Treasury is trying everything under their power to unlock the interbank lending market. At this point, the banks are still holding cash and lack of trust for one another. What do you think the best way to get the system unlocked? Again, I think that they're hoarding cash is that it's a twofold thing. One, they're hoarding cash because they don't trust everybody because their capital stretched so thin. I also think the other problem is that there's more people clamoring for loans than they have the ability to give them to. So it gives the appearance of hoarding cash as well, too. They don't want to hand out loans to a lot of these people because they don't trust them. That's where the high rates come from. Recapitalize. Put more capital. Capital means that they have to raise equity like Bank of America did yesterday. Preferred stock, common stock, maybe some kind of a subordinated debt issue, although that's a little bit grayer area. And to get their capital recap, that gives them the capacity to hand out more loans. That gives them the capacity to take a loss on a loan. Because the other problem was when you're at capacity, you really are not in a position to take losses. I think that ultimately that's going to be the fix to get the interbank lending market moving. That's the preferred fix. The other fix is that we just let enough firms go out of business so that it then the amount of loans available meets the amount of money that is out of there that is out there right now. That's definitely what we want to do. What we don't want to do. We don't want to deleverage. Stephen writes, doesn't the Fed decision to pay interest on reserve balances inject capital into the banks even in a small way? It does. Yes, you could say that there's $1.3 trillion out there, and now they're going to get 75 basis points on excess reserves and 1.4% on reserve balances. But that's divided by 360, so they get 1/360th of it every day. It will help to recapitalize the banking system, inject capital in the banking system, over a period of months, if not years. We got the Dow down 156. We want the banking system fixed in an hour and a half. We don't want to wait that long for a plan like this to help recapitalize the banking system, in much the same way that a plan that creates a positive yield curve will take way too long to recapitalize the banking system. All right, let me go back to a live question. Heidi, you're with us. Are you there? Hello, Heidi. Oh, I guess. Heidi, are you there? That she wasn't there. She was, and she did, and she dropped off. Let me go back to some more of the email questions. I'll take them for 9 more minutes. Remember, we do a transcript. If I don't get to a question, I will add it into the transcript as well, too. This comes from Michael. I don't believe the AICPA and FASB require firms to market liquid assets in distressed markets to market. That is true. That is what I said is what the AICPA and the FASB has come out, if I misspoke earlier. They said that. They said you do not have to market liquid assets to distressed market levels. They were very clear on that earlier this year and even last year in a lot of statements as far as what management judgment means for level three. The question is, why are they being marked there anyway? And the answer is, I think, that the auditing firms, the accountant firms, the Deloitte and Touches, the Grant Thorntons, the PricewaterhouseCoopers, that's where they want it marked. And if you don't mark it there, you're not getting an unqualified opinion. And if you don't like it, go ahead and put on the tape that you want to change accountants on October 8th and see what the reaction will be to a financial firm is that they fire their accountant in the fourth quarter. So you're not going to do that. So you're going to acquiesce to what the accountant does. If you remember last year, and I remember talking about this on the calls and writing about this last year, there was a number of CFOs screaming and yelling that the auditors, the accountants, were forcing them to take the marks at those levels. Again, why do they have those marks at those levels? Because this is the legacy of Enron. Enron worked under the old system, held to maturity, available for sale. They cooked the books. They blew up. We liquidated Arthur Andersen. And every accountant knows, or they fear these financial firms. They say, I don't want to put an unqualified opinion on a bank and then have it blow up because their assets were marked in the wrong way. They're going to liquidate my accounting firm. So I have to protect myself after the Andersen legacy. The problem is you can cajole the accountants all you want. Don't do liquidation. And the accountants are, if I use another number and the firm blows up, am I going to be sued? Yes, you're going to be sued. Am I at risk? Yes, you're at risk. So the accountants are acting in their own best interest. We should have never let Andersen blow up like we did after Enron. That was the problem. And the last thing about mark-to-market accounting, it was the response to Enron and to available for sale and held to maturity. That's why we invented it. The old system was rife with fraud and abuse, and that's why why we have a problem. We moved to this issue that we moved in with mark-to-market accounting was because we looked at the old system and said it was wrong. Now we're looking at this system and we're saying that it creates problems. There is no easy solution to this. Whatever we do either reduces transparency or puts everybody subject to an arbitrary policy. So there is no easy solution, and that's why I wanted to point out again, if they did away with mark-to-market, the next question is, go to your auditor, Grant Thornton or PricewaterhouseCoopers, and say, okay, so all those CDOs now that we're carrying at 20 cents on the dollar, we can revalue them back to 45 cents now for fourth quarter, right? And you're going to sign off on that and give me an unqualified opinion? I don't know what the accountants are going to say, but my guess is they're going to say no. I'm not going to take that risk. Because if I allow you to do that and then the firm blows up, I might be at risk for allowing this stuff and giving you an unqualified opinion. All right, a couple more questions. Wayne writes in theory, the Fed is buying assets with money that they should be getting from selling bonds. When the market returns normal, shouldn't we assume that the Fed will be selling those assets? And if they do this and they retire the debt, shouldn't this be able to avoid an inflationary environment? Yes. If the Fed sells those assets when we get to a normal environment, it will avoid an inflationary problem. But the question you have to ask is, when we blow the whistle and say it's normal now, can we liquidate $500 billion of Fed loans and of Fed guarantees and of excess reserves without it pushing us back into a crisis? Remember Japan. They had quantitative easing and zero interest rates for 12 years. They tried to say 2 years ago, okay, let's now move off of zero because our economy is getting better. And everybody was so afraid of what might happen if they move off zero, they went to 50 basis points and they stopped. And so they know that they've got this emergency rate. They don't know how to get out from underneath it because they're afraid that if they jack up rates, they're going to send their economy right back into the soup. So the Fed's going to have the problem of whenever we think that the problem is solved and that we've gotten past the potential deflation, now let's have a big deflationary event of trying to get rid of $500 billion worth excess liquidity. So it's easier said than done. When do you say that the markets are stable enough that the Fed could liquidate that without a problem? Nobody knows the answer. All right, the last question I'll take, and there's a bunch more here, and I will add those to the transcript, which we'll hopefully have out Friday, is from Vincent. Or Christopher, excuse me. Did the VIX get recalibrated? People quote historical highs, but I thought it changed at some point. Yes. The VIX early on was the S&P 100. It was it hit a high during the stock market crash of 1987 of 172 on the S&P 5. It was the S&P 100, which hit a high of 172 during the stock market crash. That's VXO now on your Bloomberg versus VIX, which is what we look at now. That number is about 10 points or so higher than what we're seeing with VIX. VIX is at 53 on your Bloomberg, but the VXO number, I think, is let me see if I could call that up here. The VXO number is now 70. So the old VIX is 70 now. The new VIX is 53. The old VIX was the S&P 100. The new VIX is the S&P 500. It was about, 8 years ago that they made the switch over. Second half of his question is the TARP a revolver. Yes, it is a revolver. All it means is that the maximum you can own is $700 billion at any one point. So you can buy these assets, sell them, buy some more, sell them, go back and forth all you want, but you can't own more than $700 billion at one point. Currently, if you can't own more than $350 billion at one point, you got to go back and ask Congress for permission to go above 350. But let's at least get to 350 first with it. So yes, it is a revolver. It's just a limit to the amount of assets that they can hold or the amount of recapitalization if they do it at any one time. If they want to go above that, well, if they buy a preferred from a bank, and maybe they could sell it back to the bank or they could sell it to private investors to free up money to go to another bank as well too. All right, I try to keep this to an hour. There's some other good questions I wish I could get to. I will try and get to those questions. I will try and get to those questions in the Q&A as we go from there. I'll try and answer the questions to those directly, and we'll go from there. So thank you for joining us, and see you in a few weeks for our next conference call. Bye-bye.